to be clicked. Yep. Okay, so we already started with simplification last time and introduced what the principles. I'm not going to go through them again. So now I want to go on and discuss the realization in Isabel. And the realization is primarily in the core of the simplification procedure in Isabel is this simp proof method. And we have not seen it explicitly, but it's part of the auto proof method. And this is the way it works. So assume you have some goal like this, and you apply this simplification procedure. So this is the name of the simplification procedure, and the add is a modifier, or you pass some additional arguments to the simplification procedure. And these must be names of existing possibly conditional equations. And what happens, the simplifier will try and simplify the whole goal according to the following principles. So it will use all the preceding lemmas that have the simp attribute in square brackets. And it will automatically also use all the rules from function definitions and from data type. Of course, if you have a function definition, it'll use those equations. Which rules from the data type will it use? If you have a data type, then it will automatically use the distinctness rules, that two constructors, two terms that start with different constructors are distinct. And it will use the injectivity rules to simplify terms. So those just happen automatically. You don't need to worry about it. And it will use those rules that you've given here, those simplification rules. And it will throw all of them and simplify the whole goal, but it will also use the assumptions to simplify the conclusion, certainly, but also to simplify each other. So it will really try and make use of the assumptions as much as possible. And, so that's the whole... That's the overview of what's happening there when you call the simplifier. And of course, if I say it uses the assumptions, it won't use, for example, the assumption P1 to simplify itself, and P1 will just disappear. So it will do it in some sensible way. They will simplify each other, but not just disappear. That's the basic version. Then you have some variations here. So for example, instead of adding or in addition to adding, you can also delete some rules which are there by default. So for example, some lemmas further up have been declared as simplification rules. And now for this particular proof step, you don't want them in there, then you can also delete them if you feel like it. On the other hand, if you have to delete something frequently, it shows that you'd better not put it in as a simplification rule in the first place. It's always better to be a bit more conservative and add things explicitly rather than remove them again. Then the auto method is similar to simp, but there are some differences. Auto, and that's something special, it acts on all the sub-goals, not just on the first one. Simp only acts on the first sub-goal. And auto applies simp and does more. Those are some differences. But typically, I start with auto, and when that auto leaves me something that I don't understand, then I back off and say, okay, let's just simplify. Maybe that's more understandable, what's left over then. Because simp does less. And you can also use the same modifiers on auto as on simp. So this is a little bit confusing, the syntax here. So this is the proof method, and these are the modifiers. And so here you have to say simp add and then some rules, or simp del and some rules. This is not the simp method. This is just the name of a modifier that modifies the auto method. And here you have to say simp add, whereas for the simplifier, you would just say add, simp and add something. So this is because the only thing you can add to the simplifier are additional simplification rules. So you don't have to qualify what you are adding. You just say add this. Whereas for auto, there are different things you can add, and this says, please add a simplification rule or delete a simplification rule, so that's why it's a bit more verbose. But it looks like this is a call to the simplifier, but it's not. This is just a modifier to the auto method. So questions about this general setup? Then let's go into more specific things. So if you want to expand a definition, remember definitions were non-recursive things and they are not expanded automatically in contrast to the fun definitions. Then you'd have to do so. You have to say simp and then you add the definition of function f. So if you define some function named f, then automatically its definition will have the name fdef. And you can add that to the simplifier and then it will rewrite with the definition. This is very useful for automating your proofs. And so please keep this possibility in mind, case splitting. Now, some of the case splitting happens automatically. If you have some big formula P and inside you have an if then else and you call the simplifier, then the simplifier will automatically split this proposition P into two propositions. It'll say, okay, let's make a case distinction. If A holds, then I have to prove P of S because then the if then else inside collapses to S. And if not A is true, then I have to prove P of T. And as you can see, you get two copies of P, so this can, in the worst case, lead to something very large and completely confusing. On the other hand, if the simplifier then, after it's done the splitting, it will keep on rewriting, and if it then has the assumption A for rewriting P of S, it may actually get further, and so often this helps to dispose of a goal completely, and you don't even see that it did that by this case distinction. So in general, that's considered a good thing, but as I said earlier, this is something that may lead to a confusing a blow up of the goal, and then you have to start thinking and you have to back off. For if then else it's automatic, for other case constructs it's not automatic because that can lead to non-termination. So for other types other than Booleans, you can still do it, but you have to do it by hand. So here is an example. If you have some big formula P and inside you have a case, and here it's a case over natural numbers, so E is is some expression over the natural numbers, and you have a case distinction. If E is zero, this evaluates to A, and if it's a successor, then it evaluates to some B, whatever A and B and E are. And you can do the same kind of case splitting for this construct as for the one up there. So here you would have two cases. If E is zero, the result is P of A. And if E is the successor for any natural number N, then it's P of B. So again, you get two cases of one for each branch. This has to be done by hand, so you have to instruct the simplifier or auto, please, when you act on this goal, also, how do you tell it which case construct to expand? The idea is you simply give it the type and say expand all case constructs of a particular type. In this case, it's the type of natural numbers. So what you have to write, you have to say, for example, for the simplifier, you give an additional modifier, say, please split, and use the splitting rule for the natural numbers. So that, if you call this this modified version of simplification, it will take, if it gets to this situation, it will rewrite it to this situation. And so, this is something that can make the difference between a long-winded case distinction by hand and something completely automatic. And this doesn't just work for natural numbers. If you have some other type, you can do the same thing, but instead of nut, you replace it with the name of that other type. So you can also do it with auto instead of simp. And in general, for any data type T, you can say T.split.
So are there any questions concerning this idea of splitting formulas when you have an if then else or a case in there? Right. So then let's move on. This is something special that as soon as you have pairs in your formalization, then you may run into this. So you can write in Isabel, you can write let the pair xy be equal to some term t, and then inside you can then make use of the x and the y. Now, if you have such an expression, you will also sometimes want to split it, this can be done automatically in the same way. This is a nice input syntax, but for certain technical reasons, this form of the let will be rewritten already automatically. And even if you input something like that, after simplification, what you will really see is this. So this is the one that you may from time to time encounter. This is the one I would use if I write down a let expression. So here it's semantically, this is the very same thing. You make a case distinction. What is the form of T? T must be of a pair type. So the only form it can be of is a pair. And then you can make use in that one and only branch. You can make use of the components X and Y of the pair. Of course, you can also always use first and second, the functions to split pairs, FST and SND, but that typically leads to less readable code with lots of first of second of first, and so this is the recommended way to deal with pairs. But if you have such an expression and you want to split it, then you can also do that. And what would either of those become? It would become this expression, or this formula. And there's no duplication going on because there is only one case. It says if T is really a pair, then P, the whole proposition around the case, must hold for the result of the expression inside. So this gets rid of the case or the let, whatever it may be. And you have to do this automatically. You have to do this by hand as well. So this is how you do it. It follows the same syntax, but the type that is being split there is the product type, and that's why it's called prod.split. So this is special, and it also, in particular in this form, it doesn't look like a case, but it becomes a case during simplification, and then you can split it like that. But that only becomes relevant if you have pairs or tuples in your formalization. So let's take a quick look at a real-life demo. Right, there we are. So here's a simple example. Yeah, of course, this isn't the real example. I mean, this is not the formula that's provable. So if you have this start term and you apply the simplifier to it, well, all that will happen is it will simplify the left-hand side. It will simplify the y's append empty list down to, after the simplification, you just have y's on the empty on the left-hand side. And then, of course, you can't go on because this is just a demo, and that's why I'm using this oops command that says, please back off, forget about this lemma. This was just for demo purposes, and then essentially you haven't changed the system state. Here is a more interesting example where more things will be going on because you have multiple assumptions, so, yep, I don't need to get up.
suggestion from the audience, if you think of the simplifications going on, what do you think will happen when you do this? Or where is simplification possible? Just suggestions. In the second assumption?
Yes.
Yes.
To add this echo to the
end. Exactly, yes. So that's the first one. What the simplifier, the only thing at first the simplifier can do is simplify this second assumption down to X is equals the empty list. Okay, what will happen next? Or what could happen next? Yep.
Then it could replace X's in the first assumption by the empty list.
Right, exactly. Here's an X's, so let's replace it by the empty list, which of course now means how can you simplify it further?
You can apply the definition of the append function.
Yeah.
And then probably there is a lemma stating that if you append an empty list to the front and to the back, then it just results in the other list.
Yes, so what is left over then from this first assumption?
The goal.
Yes, exactly. Z S equals Y S is left over. You don't even need to do this. What will happen then is the assumptions will have been simplified as much as possible, but now you have an equation here, and you can use this equation to replace Z S by Y S, and then so this Z S in the conclusion will become Y S, and then you have Y S equals Y S. Okay, you got it. And indeed, let's see what happens if I do simp. It says no subgoals, which is, of course, not very informative. And in our discussion, I hope it became clear what really happened inside. But typically, you're not really interested in how it was proved. You're just very happy that you have proved yet another lemma. Questions about what happened here? Then let's do a bit more in the sense of adding more rules. Let's look at this one. So this is just a basic result from arithmetic, and here I have restricted b to be an integer. And if you just do simp, nothing much will happen. So let's do apply simp. And it said fail to apply proof method, which means it couldn't do anything. The simplifier just couldn't change the goal. Why is that? That's because the simplifier does not automatically expand, does not automatically use distributivity, because if you have a big term and you automatically use distributivity, it may blow up. And so it's not used automatically. And if you want to use it, then you can either search for this particular rule, but in this example or in general, I recommend to use something called algebra simps. So this is a whole list of rules that are useful for simplifying terms in some algebraic setting, if it's a ring or a group or whatever. And it will apply the rules of that algebraic structure. And of course, it can still blow up, but in many cases, it will simplify the term down to something much simpler. And in this case, it'll even prove the goal, because if you do apply distributivity on the left-hand side, and if you then cancel terms that appear on both sides, and you cancel positive and negative terms, and all of that happens through the algebra simp rules, so they are set up to perform those high school manipulations of algebraic terms, then in this case it works out well. So this is an example of simp, and it's an example of something that I think will be useful more than once in this course, because we will, when we reason about running times, for example, we will have algebraic terms with numbers in them, and then this simplification list of simplification rules will come in useful. And this is a way of declaring one or more simplification rules, declaring one or more theorems as simplification rules, giving them the simp attribute, and then below you don't need to add things explicitly anymore. Yes, here's the example of rewriting with definitions. So if you have a definition of the SQ function, then if you want to expand the SQ function in your theorem, like here is the square of n times n is the same as the square of n times the square of n, which is almost a triviality, then you can prove this by adding the square definition, and it will prove it automatically. Here are some examples where the automatic case splitting in the if-then-else is shown. So, for example, A and B is the same as if A, then B, else false, and that can be proved by simplification. Because what the simplifier will do, it will make this case distinction, and if A is true, well, then the left-hand side collapses to B, and the right-hand side also collapses to B. And if A is false, well, then the left-hand side becomes false, and the right-hand side also becomes false. So in both cases, this is a true identity, and therefore it has been proved automatically by the simplifier. And here you can see it explicitly. If you just look at what the term if A then B else C becomes if you simplify it, so this is the start goal. If you simplify it, you get exactly this case distinction. A should imply B and not A should imply C. So here we just used a formula where all three of the components A, B, and C are of type bool, and therefore this is what the result is, just a Boolean combination. And auto would have proved this directly, because auto wouldn't stop here. Auto would say, oh, I know how to do with it. I know what to do with conjunctions and implications, and it would go further. And I think, oh, no, sorry, it's not provable. Forget this. This is not a provable goal. But auto would do more. We can look at this. Auto wouldn't stop at that point. Auto would split it up into two sub-goals and would already move the A and the not A into the assumptions. And so you get a more... auto leaves over something that's more focused, in the sense you really, you see, this precisely is as far as I got. And I have even split it up into several sub-goals. And this is really what you need to focus on, the B or the C. Where simp stops earlier in this case. Here's the final example where we prove something by case splitting. Why is this a true theorem? I'm claiming that A is less than or equal than this case construct. Well, the case construct in the first branch, it'll return a 1. So that's certainly true. 1 is less or equal 1. And in the second branch, it'll return a successor of something. And of course, a successor of anything is greater or equal 1. So if you make this case distinction, then this is provable. But you have to instruct the simplifier to make this case distinction. And therefore, you add this split. You say, please modify your computation by also using this splitting rule for lists. And I think, a little bit of arithmetic is built into the simplifier, something called linear arithmetic. So some simple goals without multiplication can be solved automatically by the simplifier. But if you have multiplication in there, then it's no longer solvable. Yes, and finally, if you do want to see what the simplifier does, here is the magic incantation to get that information out of the simplifier. You have to say using simp trace in front of the simp, and then you get a long, more or less readable trace. In most cases, it'll be less readable because a lot of work will be going on there. But sometimes it's readable and helpful. Okay, then let's close the chapter on simplification and let's get back to... to a little case study.
because we want to get closer to our actual lecturing material, and so we will start with a little case study on binary search trees. And we need sets, so you get a short preview of sets. I will go into them in more detail in later on. So there is a type of sets, like there's a type of lists parameterized with the element type, and there are the usual operations, elementhood, union, etc. And we also have bounded quantification, so you can write something for all elements in some set, some property is true. And luckily, Auto knows a little bit about sets, so we can rely, at least for these simple examples, we can rely on the automation inside Auto. And now I would like to introduce you to a library that's already there. This is how you import it, so you don't need to import main as well. This will import main, but it will also import the tree library. And I'll just give you a short overview of what's in there. So this is if you want to look at the whole file, but yeah, I didn't even need to tell you that, because once you import this, you can click on it and it'll take you to that file. But this is where the file is actually located. So this is the key type definition in there of a binary tree or binary trees. A type of tree where you have two constructors. One is called a leaf. That's the empty tree. That's the end of your the data structure. Or it's a node that has a subtree and an element of the information that you want to store in the tree and another subtree. And there is for a nice display, but you can also use it for typing. You don't have to type leaf, you can also type this. And similarly, node with the left subtree and some information, and the right subtree is displayed as this kind of tuple, but with angular brackets rather than round brackets. And yeah, so makes sense? Or any questions about the type itself? Then let's move on to the library functions, the basic functions that are defined in there and for which there are lots of theorems in there. The size of a tree is simply the number of nodes. So it's a function from trees to natural numbers, and the size of the leaf node. Sorry, I shouldn't say leaf node because that's confusing. When I say node, I really mean a node rather than a leaf. So the size of a leaf is zero, and the size of a node is just the sum of the sizes of the subtrees plus one. And the height of a tree, well, this is how it's defined. A leaf has height zero, and a node has the maximum height of the two subtrees, again, plus one. And there's a function to convert a tree into a set, or to extract all the information in this tree into a set. And that, again, is just recursive. There's nothing in a leaf. And in a node, well, you just take the union of the subtree sets and also join in the element inside the node. The A goes in there. There's a function for an in-order listing of the tree. So you flatten the tree into a list. And, of course, the flattened leaf is just the empty list. And if you want to flatten a node with L, X, and R in it, you first flatten the left subtree, then comes the element in the middle, and then comes the right subtree. So completely canonical definitions. And then there is also a binary search tree predicate. So when is a tree a binary search tree? And that's also defined recursively. Of course, the leaf is always a binary search tree. And when is a node consisting of a left subtree, an element A, and a right subtree a binary search tree? Well, if and only if both subtrees are binary search trees and the element in the node is between the elements in the left subtree and the right subtree. So for all the elements in the left subtree L, those must be below our middle element A,
and all the elements in the right subtree must be strictly above the element that we have in our node here. So I assume that makes sense, but it raises the question, does that really work for any type A? We've made assumption there. What assumption have we made here? Yeah, so we're using a comparison function on type A. So this is not the full truth when I write down this type here. The truth is that it only works for A's that are in what is called the type class of things that have a less than relation on them. And this is a short one slide introduction to Isabel type classes. We won't be using them much, but they will be there for these ordered types, which are of course pervasive in our search tree and other applications. So what's a type class? It's similar to what you have in Haskell, if you know that. If you don't know Haskell, it doesn't matter. This one slide is all you need to know. You can think of a type class being defined by an interface, the set of functions that you expect to exist in any type of that class. If you read class, don't think Java. So a type class is really a collection of types, and you can more or less equate it with an interface that you expect all of these types to have. And now this is something that goes beyond programming languages, because here we also have logic, and so our type classes also contain axioms that describe the expected behavior of those functions in the interface. And here is a simple example, not in the full Angori Isabel syntax, but just informally. There is in the system something class linOrder, predefined, and those stands for all the linear orders with the symbols less than or equal and less than. So in order for some type to lie in that class, it really has to have those two symbols defined, and the definition must be such that it's a linear order, so that the axioms of the linear order hold. And yeah, this is in general the key relationship between a single type and the type class. You can say that a type belongs to a type class, and for that it has to have all the interface functions defined, and they have to satisfy the axioms. Now, we won't be defining our own type classes, and we will only work with types that have already been proved to be linear orders and partial orders. So I'm not going into those details, but this is the general setup. So here you do need proofs, but I don't think we will ever need those proofs, because we will just be working with types where it has been proved that they are of a particular class. This is just a bit of notation. Just like I can say a value has a type, I can now say a type has a type class. So this is the notation for it, that the type tau belongs to that class C, meaning it has those functions and they satisfy those axioms. And here is a simple example. This is the real type of the BST function, the binary search tree predicate. It says, it works for a tree over any type A as long as that type A is in the type class lin order. So this is what you really have to write down, and the previous slide was inaccurate. Yes.
Can you also inherit from multiple type orders?
Yes, you can. Yeah. I don't think we will need that, but yeah. And now I would like to go through just a simple demo to familiarize you with the tree library and define some simple functions on them, prove a little theorem, and already motivate why we want to go beyond what we currently have, but also reinforce some of the things I said earlier. Okay. I have only added this library, this demo to the repository yesterday. You will need it for the exercises, so do update your copy of the repository before you start the exercises. Let's go through the file. So I am importing the tree library. The syntax is, here I'm using an old-fashioned syntax. I should change this. This is really the way it should be written, is the way it's on the slides. This still works, but it'll stop working at some point. Library tree. This is something that whenever you have some little functional program with a let in it, you should declare this simplification rule for lets to be active, to be, because in almost all cases, that's what you want. You want to expand a let. This is not a let over pairs, just simple let. So let x equals t in u, and then this will rewrite it by always replacing all the x's by t in u. And most of the time, this is what you want. It's not active by default, because there are enough situations in general, if you're not in such a specific programming environment, where you don't want it, and so it's not active in general. Yes, so here is the first function, there we are. The isIn function on a binary search tree. So it takes as the first argument some element x, which is of some linear order type, and then it takes a tree and returns the... I'm on the wrong one. Here's what I wanted to be. Right, there we are. And it returns the truth value. Is this element in the tree or not? And the argument order is a different one. It takes the tree and then the element and returns bool. And it's just a straightforward recursive descent in the tree, comparing the element that you have with the element in the nodes as you recurse down the tree. So I sincerely hope you've seen such algorithms before, and I don't need to go into them again. Similarly, for the insert function, it's also a straightforward... I shouldn't be doing this. Straightforward recursive descent. If you hit a leaf, then you just create a node that contains only that element x that you want to insert, and the two subtrees are leaves. And if you hit a node, then you have to compare... Is it in less than or greater than? And if it's neither less than nor greater than, then because it's a linear order, you know it must be equal, and then you don't need to do anything in this last case. Actually, it shouldn't. Then you shouldn't be doing anything in this last case. You just return the same tree that you have input into the function, this tree here. But of course, if the x is less than a, then you really need to insert the x in the left subtree. So you recreate the node and recurse in the left subtree with the x. So none of this should be novel to you. So let's first prove correctness. And functional correctness is expressed, functional correctness of isIn is expressed by this property, that isIn behaves like the element operation on the elements of the tree. So asking whether x is in t with the isIn function should be the same as testing whether the element x is in the set of elements that the tree represents. So we're using this predefined library function to specify or to prove the characteristic property of the isIn function. And we will need this property that the tree is a binary search tree, because otherwise you might be going down the wrong branch and not finding it in the tree because it's not where it's supposed to be. And this works completely automatically. You do an induction on the trees and auto does it for you. What would be the functional correctness property for insert? How would you phrase that? Insert of X into T. You can, my claim is we can express this as a single equality. And you should sort of generalize what you've seen there for the isin function. So remember, we have the set tree function that will play some role for you. Yes?
Maybe if we insert X into the tree and pull the set from it,
right.
It should be the same as if we insert X into the set tree of T.
Yep, that's exactly it. If afterwards you take the elements, they should be the same as the elements beforehand, plus the element X. So, well, let's do it the other way around for certain reasons. Yes, set tree of T, union is single the set X. And what we see here is an instance of something more general that I will explain in more generality later on. But what we're doing here is we're proving that the tree is a refinement of sets, and we're using a function that maps the trees back to the sets, and we express all these properties in a canonical manner that say, in this case, what is the set afterwards? Well, it has to have be the set beforehand, but manipulated by the corresponding function. Here it's the insert function, or rather the union with the singleton function. And while we're at it, what would be the specification of the delete function? So if you have delete X from T, how would you specify that? Yes. Yes, and the difference on sets is written minus in Isabel. But the C is practically identical. You're expressing a relationship between some concrete implementation, a delete or an insert, and some abstract specification, in this case, the union or the set difference function. So that's the general principle, but I will come back to this general principle again. I'm just motivating why the lemmas that we are proving don't just drop out of thin air, but there is a canonical principle behind them. Yes, so luckily the insert function, we can prove this property that I wrote up there just as easily as for the isin. Now, interestingly enough, we don't need a BST predicate here in front of it. So this works for arbitrary trees, not just for binary search trees. It is a little bit surprising, but if you think about it for a moment, you begin to realize why this may be the case. But, it's even better. Now, what we also need to show is that all the functions that we have preserve the invariant, so that if you have a binary search tree to start with and you insert something, you still have a binary search tree, and if you delete something, you still have a binary search tree, and so this is what happens next. And here, the proof is again by the standard method, but if you just do auto, you will see you are stuck with something. And then you see a long subgoal. Actually, I don't like this way of displaying my subgoals. It's somewhere, I think it's, where is it here, I think. Maybe plugin options. Can't find it now. Probably here somewhere, but it's, forget it. We'll have to live with it. So why couldn't it prove that? And then you have to stare hard at this sub-goal, and then you see, oh yes, there's this, there's a formula inside a set tree of ints. And we have already proved that the set of elements after the insert is this union. And so this is why we have to add this lemma in. So this is the lemma that set tree of ints is something. And this helped to prove the actual goal of preservation of the invariant. Yeah, there we were. So that was insertion. Now let's look at deletion. So how does deletion work in general in a binary search tree? If you want to delete an inner node, what do you do? Well, you always, the standard, not very efficient way, if you have some inner node here and you want to delete this one, this element, then you take the either this element, the successor, or the predecessor, that were element, and move them up there. And so you need an auxiliary function that goes down either this subtree or that subtree and returns you, the element that you have to replace here and the remainder subtree that it was left over from the removal of this element. So we need two functions, the main delete function and this auxiliary function, where we split the tree. What we will do is we will take this subtree here and we will split off this element. And since we are working with binary search trees, we will call this the split min function that splits the tree into its minimum element and the remainder of the tree. And this is where we see a let with a pair, because now it's inevitable we need the pairs. Of course, you could write two functions, one which returns the minimum of the tree and another one that removes the minimum, and then call both of them, but that's a very inefficient way of doing it. So we write a function that does both at the same time. And if you have a node here and you want to split the minimum, well, first you check maybe the left part of the node is the leaf. Well, then you have already found the minimum, because then A is the minimum if L is a leaf, and you can just return the A and the R. But in general, it will be a proper node with the left subtree being a non-leaf, and then you first recall recursively. You call split min recursively on the left part of the tree. You get the minimum element and a remainder tree, a modified part of the left tree. And then you return that minimum element and you rebuild the tree with L being replaced by L prime, and you return that pair. And now you can, so here's how you write the pair that you return. So the star is just the product or pair forming operator on the type level. And then you can use the split min function to delete elements from the tree. And this is how it works. Of course, from the empty tree, you can't delete anything. You just stay empty. And here is the interesting case. We want to delete something from a node. And if it's on the left side or the right side, you simply recurse down the left side or the right side and delete it in there and rebuild the tree. But in the last case, we know it's neither less nor greater than, since it's a linear order, it must be equal. So then you have to ask yourself, am I in the lucky position that R is a leaf? Well, then you can remove A very easily and just return L. That's the easy option. But if it's if R is non-empty, then we go to this situation on the board and we call the split min function, R into A prime and R prime, and then you rebuild the tree and L stays unchanged. The original contents of the node is replaced by this minimum element, and the right tree is replaced by the modified right tree. And when I say replaced, of course, we're not in a imperative setting where you really change existing things, but you build a new tree. So, questions about that? Then let's prove it. And right. So first, we have to prove something about the split min function, and it's on the face of it quite obvious. If you split the tree into two components, the minimum element and the remainder tree, then the set tree of T prime of the remainder tree should be the set tree of T minus the element that you've taken out. And for some reason, that seems not to work. So let's try it. And we just do apply induction on, do we do induction on? So we could just do induction on T, because everything, I think, is defined by primitive recursion on T, so that should work well. Oops. I hate that. On T, and we probably need, let's just leave it like that. And then it becomes something large, and we just say apply auto and see if we are happier with that. Right, so you can already see there's a problem with the first sub-goal and with the definition of delete min. Or rather, the definition of delete min is okay, but somehow what we're trying to prove doesn't quite work for that definition. So what's the problem? What do we need to modify? How do we need to modify our lemma that we're trying to prove? So I'll just show you the split min again. Yep.
We can't use any split min simplification group because the tree is empty and the function is not defined for an empty tree.
And that's intentional, because we will never call it for a non-empty tree.
So we want to assume that the tree is not empty.
Yes. So let's do that. And I'm not sure whether the order matters. T is not equal to leaf. And let's try again. So here you see the leaf has been echoed down at the bottom with the nice syntax. So induction on T and auto. Now we have five subgoals. It looks like the base case has disappeared, but auto has split up the induction step into five different ones. Now, this is quite tedious to look at, so I will give you a hint or rather, yeah. Maybe one can see what's the problem, what the problem is. Let's see. This is the full sub-goal. Ah, yes. The first thing I would do, I'm not sure it's really necessary, but here you can see, it may even be harmful, but you can see that there are, this is part of the premise. There's an if-then-else in the premise. Now, I told you earlier that if-then-elses are automatically split by the simplifier. This is not quite true. They're only automatically split if they're in the conclusion. If they're in the premises, it can sometimes be harmful to split it. And so it's not done automatically here. We have to do it by hand. I somehow suspect I'm barking up the wrong subtree, but let's just why is it? Right. Auto, and now I say split. If splits is also there, and splits means not just the one for the conclusion, but also the one for the premises, therefore the plural. And now we get six subgoals. And the first one is supposed to be contradictory. Yeah, this is really weird. Now, I can tell you what we also need to do, but I don't think I could easily read it off from this proof at sub-goal. The problem is that we want to say here in this lemma, in our inductive proof, we want to say, well, if you split t, no matter what x and t prime come out of it, they have some properties. So you should say arbitrary. And that may, that hopefully does more. We still have six sub-goals. I know what's missing, but again, I don't think... I think I would have to look at this quite hard for a long time to realize what's missing. We need one more assumption about the tree.
It's a binary search
tree. Yes. I can't... looking at this subgoal, I can't tell you this is exactly how you would spot that. We are relying on this when we descend down the tree. It's not unnatural to also assume that it's a binary search tree. It's become a bit better. Now, I have the suspicion I don't actually want to do this. This was something I suddenly thought of, I'm not sure it's a good idea. Maybe it was a good idea. So somehow I'm getting stuck myself, and I'm allowing myself to read on. You really have to look hard here. This is the full lemma that will work. So here's we didn't have enough information. That's why the prover didn't get very far. We forgot to say, or we didn't realize, that we need to prove two things simultaneously. I hate this one. Got that. Right, there we are. We need to prove simultaneously that this set difference relation holds, and of course we need to say something about X. We want to know that X is also in the tree, and this is actually crucial in the proof. If you don't have that information, then the proof is not going to go through. You need to prove both properties simultaneously, and then the proof works. But now I will. We can just go through the mechanics of it. This is what I already added, but I forgot to add this one, so that's why we didn't get very far. The base case goes through just by simplification, and in the inductive step, we actually need more than auto. If you just have auto here. And this, by the way, the if-split assumption is a more precise way of saying I want the rule for splitting if in assumption, but you can also just say if-splits, which gets you all of them. And auto will still leave something over. There's also a prot-split, so we also need to split pairs. I think I should have seen this up here. Let's go back here in the failed proof attempt. Well, there was the if-then-else, which I undid, so it was a good idea to do it that way. Split if splits. And yes, I should have seen this one. Here's a case over a pair. So this is what we also need to split. You have a case over the result of split min, and we need to get rid of that. And so this is why we also added in the proof below prod.splits. And now it's really, I think this is as far as you get just by mechanically saying, oh, I need to get rid of this case and I need to get rid of this if. Now, if you look hard at it, then it should transpire that you also need the information that the element that you get out of the split min is a part of the tree that you put into it. But I'm not going to walk through all of these assumptions and motivate why that particular property is needed to complete the proof. And then you find that even if you have that property, if you just use auto on it, it's still not enough. And this is a motivation. You need more proof power, and there is something called force instead of auto. Force just works on a single subgoal, and it managed to prove this. But of course, there's always a limit to how much proof power you have. I'm just telling you now, and repeat it in a moment, that auto is not the end of the line. There is more proof automation available, and in this particular proof, you did need the additional proof proof power given to you by the force proof method. So this motivated why you need all of these ingredients, the split rules, and the things like arbitrary, but that you also need more more forceful proof procedures. But of course, this is something you don't... this is something you just have to try. If auto leaves something over that looks reasonable, but it couldn't complete the proof, let's see if this is the case. If you look at this subgoal... Yeah, but it's not obvious that this is a true subgoal and that you should just use more proof power to solve it. You would have to look at it closely to see why, yes, it's true, it should be provable, and let's try something, let's try harder with force. Questions about all these things that you've seen? Then let's go back to the slides. And let's step back and let's... well, this was easy. It isn't quite true for the delete function. For the others, it was easy. but yeah, difficult problems need more than induction and auto, and this is what the last example has demonstrated. And so first we will introduce more logic and more automation, and then in the last one or two lectures of the first part, I will introduce a structured way of writing proofs so that you don't get lost in all the hypotheses, but can write down things as you would on a sheet of paper. So first, logic. We have already seen things like AND and implications and quantifiers, so let's be complete and let's introduce all of it. So what do we have? This is the rough syntax of the formulas in HOL. What is a formula? It can be a formula in parentheses, it can be an equality, it can be a negation, it can be an AND or an OR or an implication between formulas. And this is the universal quantifier. We even saw a variant of this where it said for all X elements some set. And this is the existential quantifier. And the order of these productions is important. It says there, in decreasing precedence. That means this is the equality is the most tightly binding operator. The negation comes afterwards, and the OR, for example, is less binds less tightly than the AND. And here you see an example. Because of the order of these precedents of the precedences, if you write down this, the system will parse it like that. The NOT is the most tightly binding operator in this formula. The AND is binds more tightly than the OR, so there are parentheses around the AND, and then the OR comes last. Here's another one. If you write S and T equals S equals T and C, then it will be parsed like that, which is what you typically want. So you can write a conjunction of equations, for example, and you don't need to put parentheses around each equation. On the other hand, if you write down an equation between Boolean terms, for example, this one, A and B equals B and A, then again, the equality will be the most tightly binding operator, and it'll be passed like that. So beware of that. When you use equality on Booleans, it's a very tightly binding operator. And so if you don't, if you wanted the one that you wrote, then you, well, if you want it to be an equality expressing commutativity of AND, then you really need to put parentheses around the A and B and parentheses around the B and A. And here's a final one that demonstrates that the quantifiers bind very weakly. So this quantifier, if you don't write anything around the AND, it will still bind all the way to here because it's weaker than the AND, and so the AND will bind more tightly. It will put those two things together, and in this case, this is really what you want. But you have to be aware of that. And you can use the if and only if instead of an equality for Boolean terms, and then it has the same precedence as the arrow, which is a low precedence, it comes towards the end. And so I recommend, if you want to, things to be nicely readable, it's often better to use this symbol rather than the equality symbol on Booleans, but that's a matter of taste. You can also have variable bindings, quantifiers binding multiple variables at the same time. So here is the universal quantifier with two variables, and that's just an abbreviation for this one. So there's nothing special there. And similarly for existential quantifiers or lambdas. Yeah, this is the warning about quantifiers, that they have the same property as case and if. Because they start with a keyword, the quantifier, but they don't end anywhere with another keyword. And so in order to make sure that you're, that they are delimited properly, you need to put parentheses around them. So have low precedence need to be parenthesized if in some context. Here we have an example there's a quantifier in some context, there's more around it, namely an and in front of it, and then you, this is what you really need to write with the parentheses around the quantifier. So do remember that quantifiers in formulas do require parentheses around them. And if you want to know how to type them, well, this is a little table that tells you how to type these mathematical symbols on the keyboard, either like this, in which case they are immediately converted to this one, or there are some alternative syntaxes that stay as they are. Well, no, it depends a little bit how you set up the interface. Typically these days, if you type in this one, the interface will already convert it to this. But you don't need to learn them by heart. You can look them up or, in fact, use the interface to look under not quite sure, symbols or something, and it'll give you all the tables. Sets we had already seen. So this is a more slightly more detailed introduction to sets. This is the type. Then we have syntax for empty set. It's just open brace, close brace. Syntax for set enumeration is again in braces the elements of the set. Then there's the element operator, the subset operator. There's union, intersection, minus for set difference. And you can also use the minus as a unary operator. Then it's the complement set, all the elements that are not in the set. And this is set comprehension, the set of all x, where x must be a single variable, such that P. And for historic reasons, we are using a dot here to emphasize the analogy with the quantifiers and the lambdas. They're all variable binding operators that you introduce a local x here and you say this is the set of all these local x, just like in a quantifier. And that's why we use the dot here. But what we mean is what you normally write with a vertical bar. And then there is lots more syntax. I may introduce more syntax as we go along, but that's just the basic syntax that you need to know. And this is again the way to type the syntax in the system. Right. And that brings us, and I think that will nicely conclude today, proof automation, more proof automation. We have already seen SIMP, which does rewriting and a bit of arithmetic, and AUTO, which does rewriting and a bit of arithmetic, and knows about logic and about sets. And they show you where they got stuck. So that's a big advantage, but they are highly incomplete. So often they can't prove something, although it would be provable with a bit more effort. And that's what I'm showing you now. That's another property. They are extensible with new SIMP rules. And they're almost the same except AUTO acts on all subgoals. So that's just a little recap of what AUTO and SIMP do. Now, there's something called fast force, and that's it does rewriting, logic sets and relations and a bit of arithmetic. So it's a bit like AUTO, but it's better than AUTO. And it only acts on a single subgoal. Incomplete, but better than AUTO. It either just succeeds or fails. In contrast to AUTO, that leaves you something that you can look at and try and figure out what's missing here. It'll just say, I could prove it, or it'll say, I can't prove it, and then you're no wiser. So that's one of the drawbacks. But again, you can extend it with new SIMP rules like AUTO and SIMP, same syntax. There's something called BLAST. Oh yeah, so fast force has a cousin called just force, and that's the one that we used, which isn't very fast and often can diverge where fast force may succeed. So you can see there's a little bit of a zoo of different methods. And I will show you in a moment one way of having the system try all of them for you. And then there's BLAST, which is In principle, a complete proof search procedure for the first order part of higher order logic, but it does logic very well, but it doesn't deal with equality, or hardly deals with equality. And so in our functional programming context, it's rarely really useful. If you have something that's just ands and ors and quantifiers and sets, great, try BLAST on it. But as soon as you have some equality between proper terms, not just an equality between a variable and a term, then it's usually not, doesn't work. Yeah. Again, it doesn't tell you why it failed. It just says couldn't prove it. And you can also extend it with new deduction rules, but I don't think we need to go into that. And then there is something extremely convenient called Sledgehammer. And that is a completely different technology. So all the ones that you've seen have been programmed in Isabel. Somebody sat down and hard-coded the proof procedure. Sledgehammer uses external provers. And so this is the architecture. On the one hand, you have the Isabel system, and then you have a collection of external ATPs, which stand for automatic theorem provers. And there's a whole community that builds these automatic theorem proving systems. And we can interact with those provers. So what Isabel will do, what the Sledgehammer component of Isabel will do, it'll take the goal and a large part of the library, or rather as small part of the library as possible, and shift it off to the external provers and say, please try and prove it. And they will then, if you're lucky, come back with a proof that will then be internalized in Isabel. There's a lot I could say about the details here, but let's just treat it as a magic black box. If you're interested, you can ask me sort of offline how this works, because it's really quite a challenge to get this right. And the characteristic is sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it typically, where SIMP works, this one is likely not to work so well, and conversely. So it really is an alternative. These ATPs really work very differently from how SIMP works, and they can often do things that SIMP can't do at all, or auto can't do at all. So it's really a very good extension of the collection of proof methods that we have available. Yeah. So do you feel lucky, then you try Sledgehammer. And before I stop with the demo, I will just introduce this. You can write by and then some proof method, and that's the same as saying apply and then done, saying, and really this is a single step proof, just this one proof method will do it. Okay, let's stop with this demo. So, here are some simple examples. A quantified formula for all x, there exists a y such that x equals y. SIMP won't do this, auto can do it, it knows enough about logic to prove such a property. On the other hand, auto can do this one as well, so this is a demonstration that auto can prove simple facts of simple properties of sets. If A is a subset of B intersect C, then A is also a subset of B union C. Not too hard, yep. And here's something that auto would no longer be able to do, so you can try and use auto on it and it'll fail. And so what does it say? What's that lemma here? It says that all elements in A have the property that they are of the form, so all strings, lists, x's in A, have the property that there exists a y such that x's can be written like this. X's is y's followed by y's. So every list in A is just a repetition of the same list twice. and you know that some US is in A, then there must be an N such that the length of US is N plus N. Yes, we can see that because US must again be of this form, some list followed by itself, and therefore the length must be double some list, some number. And this is something that Otto could no longer do, but FastForce could do. Now, if you don't want to go through them one by one, what you can do, you can say, try zero. Danke. And then try zero will actually go through, as you say, see down here, trying simp, auto, blast, metis, blah, blah, a long list. And then it does find three different proofs, twice. Two different proofs. Fast force can do it, and force can do it in 2 milliseconds and 6 milliseconds, and then it suggests, why don't you use fast force? And then you can actually click on this, and it'll transport it up into the upper window. Of course, you still have to delete this bit, but that's an easy way of trying all the different proof methods. But it has one big drawback. It only tries the pure proof methods. It doesn't add anything to them. It doesn't add any simplification rules to them. So only if the goal is provable without any additional lemmas, then it will find it. It won't try anything fancy. But it's still worth remembering that. And here's something that BLAST is good at, and I don't think I want to go through the details of this. It's an encoding of the property that if a relation is total, T is total and A is antisymmetric, and T is a subset of A, then A is a subset of T. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's not very typical for our course here. So let's skip over that one. And this one is now beginning. This is an example of where Sledgehammer comes in useful. So this is a formula about transitive closure of relations. So the up arrow star is the built-in transitive closure operator on relations, meaning sets of pairs. And it says something quite trivial, namely that R star is a subset of R union S star. And if you try simp and auto and fast force, they won't do anything on this because they just don't know about transitive reflexive closures. On the other hand, Sledgehammer will always use the background library and use some subset of the background library, ship it off to the external provers, and therefore no matter what operators you have in there, there's still a reasonable chance that Sledgehammer will be able to prove something about it. As long as you have a decent background library over those operators. So let's try Sledgehammer, and we can do that by clicking down here on Sledgehammer and then click on the Apply button. And it very readily finds. Now, this is a bit funny because I just said simp can't do it. Well, simp actually can do it, but you need to know that there is a lemma called R truncal mono, which typically you don't know, and so what comes back from these external provers is some very convoluted proof typically, and then the Sledgehammer component will try and translate it back into some standard Isabel proof, and here this worked. It could translate it back into this proof, and that proves the property. Of course, it's not always that simple, the proof. So we could, for example, prove that R minus T is subset of R union S star. That's just maybe it's still provable by the same goal. I wonder. Let's call Sledgehammer again. Apply it again, I meant. Oh, yeah, it's still found that this is something where Sledgehammer had to work hard and translate it back into the simp procedure. This is more typical. The last one is typical of a standard Sledgehammer proof. It uses some proof method that you've never heard of, and it uses lemmas that you've never heard of, soup.co-bounded introduction. So it can really come up with very strange proofs, but... as long as you have a proof, you're typically quite happy. And it has the advantage you can now really, this is really the full proof, or rather all the lemmas that are needed for the proof. So you can go over, so for example, this one, union subset if, click on it, and it'll take you there. So use that lemma that a union is subset of some set if and only if both sets are a subset of that set. Mm. So this is a very quick introduction to Sledgehammer. So let me conclude with a demo where you can actually come up with some property and we can see if Sledgehammer can prove it. So this is for you to suggest what is a property of X's and Y's that should follow from this equation. Remember, the hash puts a single element in front and the at appends two lists. So what does that equality imply about X's and Y's? Just some random property that you can think of. There's no specific property that I'm aiming for. There are simpler ones and more complicated ones, and we can then try and see if Sledgehammer can prove it. Yes?
Reverse.
Pardon?
Reverse.
What about reverse? Reverse is a function. So. Yes. Okay, yeah, we can say that. Let's just take one of the two to make it simpler. So X's must have an A at the end, you're saying. So there must exist an X's prime, and X's is equal to X's prime followed by A. Is that what you're saying? Right, let's see. And let's ask Sledgehammer about this. Oops. There we are, apply. And it's also trying some system over the internet, and I don't seem to be connected at the moment, so that's why it's giving me this error message, but you can ignore that. Ooh, doesn't seem to be very successful. The problem is that, right here. Let me look at the output here. No, that's just going to go. Okay, so it couldn't prove it. Now there are two possibilities. It's unprovable, or the system was too weak. What do you think? Is this a true property? Well, I'll tell you, it's not true. Why not? X's could be the list, or the whole list could be just A. Right, so what does that mean for X's?
X's would be the empty list.
Right, so let's try that. Let's try and weaken our goal. Let's say X's is the empty list, or there exists such a decomposition. And now let's see what Sledgehammer says to that. Proof found, it already says. And yep, it's a two lemma proof. The first one, we go to it. It says this is a lemma about the equality between two lists, and it's a rather complicated lemma with existential quantifiers, so I don't want to look at the detail. And the second one is the injectivity of the cons operator. And that's all you need. So that one did work. And with that, I've come to the end of the lecture. Any last questions about anything? We still have a minute? No? Okay. Well, in that case, enjoy the weekend once you've gone through the tutorial.